Hi, Ted Levine. Welcome again to KBOO.
Glad to be back with you, Bill.
Ted Levine is in Western New York. He's been living the COVID epidemic in New York City, working throughout his hospital, much in the COVID wards and the hellish conditions without proper protective equipment, without enough ventilators, comforting patients, watching people die, including some of his fellow nurses. He himself got infected a week or more of another kind of hell, but recovered, then was called back to work. He's a union activist, became a spokesperson at nurse rallies and with media. This is the second of a two-part interview. Last week, we discussed what's happening to nursing and the profession over the last several months. Like Ted, for many, it's been even more heartbreaking and exhausting and fearing for their lives and their families' lives. But going through hell, they've learned a lot, saw the disparities and deficiencies of the U.S. medical system as mostly the poor and vulnerable died. So they're being asked to risk their lives because of gross cutbacks of funding for public health, for hospital preparation. And it was clear why, because the elites running the economic and medical system and were dominant in political decision-making, they were most interested in reducing their taxes and building up the military, police, and prisons. So while others were dying and nurses and all essential workers risking their lives, the elites were sheltering in place, working from offices and luxurious apartments and country homes, making life and death decisions about others. Still with all that, the nurses, they also felt the great respect and appreciation and love they were receiving from the people in this country for their skills, for their selfless efforts, for risking their lives out of commitment to their patients and to the profession, to public service. And gaining that public respect and appreciation, nurses and all the, and their allies and other health workers, the many health workers, essential workers in the whole health system, they gain pride and confidence in themselves. From being invisible, they become essential and greatly appreciated. This all creates great organizing and political potentials for changing lots of American systems, not just the medical systems. Ted, lots of lefties, political pundits see COVID and this period offering transformative opportunities. So could COVID and the problems our medical system create the forces to reconstruct that system, maybe even winning universal single-payer Medicare for all, among many other things? So, Ted, let's discuss that political potential. What do you see nurses and their many allies fighting for?
Well, the crisis certainly lays bare the inadequacy of the current system as it's constructed to deal with this sort of a thing. So many things need to change, and it's not just around healthcare. Broader social changes are necessary in order for us to be able to confront this crisis. Certainly things like single-payer healthcare. People are worried that they're not going to be able to pay for a medical appointment. They're going to delay going. Their illness is going to get worse. Other people are going to be exposed, and the pandemic spreads. Certainly, real universal health care, beyond the kind of false promise of Obamacare and things like that, is essential. And nurses have been on the front lines of fighting for universal health care, single payer, for decades, and continue to do so. And I think in a heightened way, or at least there's the potential for a heightened level of struggle in this crisis and in response to the crisis. But also, it raises much broader social and economic issues. If people are relying on their income and there's no adequate social replacement for lost income, they're going to go out and work. It's absurd and cruel to expect that people will not go out and work. You know, there's so many people who work in the informal economy who have that option. There's a lot of pressure on construction. There are unclear definitions of what's essential construction. In many states, the political authorities are outright telling people to go back to work. So social distancing is not working to nearly the extent that it should because we're not replacing lost income for people who are living paycheck to paycheck. So something like a social wage or a real replacement of lost income for people who should be staying at home is essential. And at least some nurses are starting to call for that in collective ways.
A lot of that is organizing great coalitions, but organizing for the kind of state that is to replace the people who are now running the state with a great number of people who at least have social democratic inclinations, who have a sense that there should be a decent safety net for everybody and jobs for all at a living wage, if we can get a state of that kind. So nurses do work in the sort of the legislative arena, and they do a lot of work there. Is that right?
Well, certainly. It has the limitations that legislative work suffers from that we know about. It tends to be very much focused on lobbying, and so the vast majority of that work is done by union staff or elected leaders in the higher offices. But there are certainly nurses who are getting involved at a rank and file and grassroots level through campaigns that are organized by the unions and through other organizations going out and speaking to the media, engaging in public protests to raise awareness about the need for greater and far-reaching legislative action. It's about lost income for workers who are sheltering in place, and also about a real robust public health response, the kind of thing that you've seen in other countries with extensive testing, contact tracing, quarantine, providing for the people who are in quarantine for their needs in terms of food and laundry and medication and other things. That type of a program requires millions of people. So that's an opportunity as well to stimulate the economy in a way that is pro-working class, in a way that promotes greater equality. People who have been laid off, who have lost their jobs, can be trained and put to work doing some of these tasks, and it's just going to take so many people. So that's one of the things that certainly I've been advocating for, and I know that my union has started advocating for, and that's going to have to be part of the fight. There's no way we're getting out of this without a really dramatic change in direction in terms of how the government is managing the pandemic.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick for the Ulmo Variety Hour. I talked to Ted Levine, a nurse in New York City, living the hell of the COVID epidemic. Like other nurses, though, he is also feeling the appreciation and respect that nurses have gained for their commitment, risking their lives. And Ted, so far in this interview, we've been discussing the nurses' union and its struggles to change our basic economic and political system towards supporting working class people. Ted, it seems to me that the COVID epidemic and its impact on nurses across the country who are watching places like New York City and so many other places around the world and in the United States and will be getting more involved as COVID comes to their communities and they see what's happening. It seems to me it's a tremendous opportunity for organizing a much more powerful nurses movement based in the nurses union. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think one key to organizing a more powerful movement is for nurses and any workers to believe that there's something big at stake, something so important that it's worth sacrificing time for, taking risks for, and just focusing their energy on in times when their energy is so scarce and it's such a low point. I think the nature of this crisis, the things that we're up against are so great and so important that they present that potential. And you're starting to see nurses willing to take risks. Nurses are speaking out to the media despite hospital policies that limit our free speech, or at least purport to limit our free speech. You see nurses going out and protesting, and at a time when there's not very much in the way of public protest, or at least there wasn't initially. We're sort of breaking the ice there. So you're starting to see cracks in the edifice, but we certainly have a long way to go. There's no guarantee that this movement explodes in the way that it needs to make this kind of a change. That's certainly the hope. And I think that people are not yet seeing the depth and the seriousness of the multiple crises that we're facing and that are going to deepen. as this goes on. A lot of people are starting to see, in a place like New York where I work, the number of cases has gone down dramatically. Things in the hospitals are quieting down. People are not feeling so stretched. So I think there's a certain level of fatigue, and there's a kind of willingness to believe that, well, it's going to keep getting better and things are going to go back to normal. But when people take a step back and look at the big picture and they see, well, the only reason these cases have gone down is because of extreme social distancing measures. And as we relax those measures, we're going to see the number of cases go back up again. And the economic hit is going to be even harder in a lot of cases. Businesses that have been stretched are going to collapse when they have to close again. People who have been stretched are going to be in absolute crisis, not able to make the rent, not able to pay the mortgage, not able to buy food. And then at the same time, we have government leaders like Cuomo in New York State who are taking advantage of the crisis to push an austerity agenda, pushing for deep, devastating cuts to public higher education and K-12 education as well. I think that we're going to see a growing awareness of the fact that we're in a crisis of our lives, of our lifetimes, and it's going to be worse than most people anticipate or see at this point. The hope is that as that happens, there's going to be a greater willingness to do the work, to organize coworkers, to push ourselves and each other to go out and fight, to take more risks and more dramatic action, to stand up to government and capital in order to get what we need, in order to stop them from just devastating the public sector, which is what they're trying to do now.
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Ted Levine, a New York nurse. We've been talking about the gain in political power and confidence, political power, public appreciation of nurses, and the possibilities of really entering the political combat for a different kind of state and a different kind of medical system. Ted, nurses also basically been in subordinate positions in hospitals, answering to a hierarchy of executives, the nurses and other staff. Through all the frontline work, still there's a sense that the doctors lead and make the decisions, and often poor decisions, and the nurses recognize it. That happened in Portland during a strike. Nurses fought OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University. I became very friendly with one of the nurses in the preemie ward, and she told her story that they sent in new doctors now and then, some interns, and the nurses knew so much more, some of them working there like her 30 years, about what you should do for the various kinds of preemies and the various machines and therapies and the way you deal with parents and the little babies. And they had to teach the doctors, but they found that over the years, doctors became much more amenable to listen to nurses. And in fact, the strike wasn't about that, although it was about nurse power. It seems to me that this is an opportunity for the nurses to, in fact, assert themselves in ways in changing their position in the hospitals and creating far more sort of democratically operating teams and recognizing nurse capacity and really democratizing the nursing system, particularly chronic disease care, which is about 70% of what, at least the medical expenses in this country, goes to, like diabetes and heart disease and cancer now is a chronic disease, not just instant death. Ted, tell us about that, the effort by nurses to gain respect and to, in fact, be able to do their jobs without being subordinate. Tell us about that.
You know, I would make a distinction between frontline doctors and, you know, in the executive offices running the hospital. I think that certainly there's a tension and there's always a struggle for respect and for our insight to be taken seriously. But at the same time, it's really a joke among many doctors, particularly, you know, the first year residents. They're in on the joke that really the nurses are teaching residents. And it's something you don't just hear from nurses, you hear it from doctors. So there's a kind of a hierarchy there, but there's also a recognition that we're working together on the front lines. And the truth is we get a lot of respect from doctors, although there certainly are plenty of examples of disrespect that people can point to. So I don't want to paint the picture as nurses good, doctors bad, or nurses subordinate, doctors dominant. I don't think that's really the way it's working nowadays. And the truth is that the doctors in hospitals have been very much proletarianized. They don't have the power and independence that you sort of imagine. I mean, they're independent providers, but there's a lot about their working conditions that creates a sense that they are also cogs in a machine. There are a lot of opportunities for solidarity between doctors, particularly the residents and interns and nurses. I will say that in this crisis, nurses are often left alone to take care of patients and make decisions. They're in the room by themselves, and there's a reluctance with some good public health justifications, reluctance for doctors to spend too much time in the rooms. But what that means is that nurses are picking up the slack, and they're in the rooms with the patients. They're the ones exposed. But you can see the potential for nurses to have more independent judgment in how they're caring for their patients, because there's less people kind of looking over their shoulders. It's sort of the nature of the crisis when resources are scarce, not just frontline resources, but also managerial resources. They can't keep on top of it. That creates problems, but it creates a certain kind of space for nurses to exercise their own judgment and expand their capacity, make good decisions, to have confidence in their decisions. Certainly, I don't want to imply that nurses are prescribing medications or giving a different dose than the ordered dose and things like that. That's not the sort of thing I'm talking about. You know, we're not practicing outside of our scope of practice, but there are many, many opportunities for nurses to make decisions that affect care and patient outcomes for the better. And that's really what I was emphasizing.
The point I was making was about chronic disease care. The systems like of diabetes control, they're still dominated by doctors and pay-for-service. And the people who are working with patients and the families to help them manage their disease better, to do exercises like in diabetes, to exercise every day, to watch their diet, how that can be done, where they can get services to help them, all of those things are shorted because so many of the physicians don't take part in it, and yet the people who are supposed to do it, the social workers and the nurses in the hospitals, it's not a sufficient priority. And the hospitals make money on the surgeries for dealing with the eye problems and the infection and the feet problems and the amputations of people with diabetes. Can go on for years and years of slicing away at people at huge profits to the hospital. But it's not good for the family or the patients. It seems to me in most of those long-term diseases, the medical parts are really subordinate to the social parts. And it's the nurses and the social workers and others who in fact do those things. And their role in it is just not sufficiently appreciated. That's where it seems to me nurses and social workers and the rest have to exert themselves to become much more important in creating care teams rather than, you know, medical technique and unnecessary medical care as the major way of dealing with some of the problems, kidney disease and so many others. They're controllable. Does that make sense to you?
You know, I work in a hospital setting, but I would say that certainly in this crisis, many of the activities, the essential activities that nurses and social workers do to prepare patients with chronic illnesses to be discharged safely, to take care of their own needs, I would imagine that many of those activities are suffering because in a lot of cases we're strapped. Certainly during the peak in my state, when we were just trying to stay afloat, running around and nurses were just trying to do the most essential things to keep their patients alive. Some of the teaching, I would imagine, has been, if not eliminated, at least not been done to the same degree that it could have under normal times. You know, this kind of goes back to a question that we haven't touched on, but that I think is really key, which is the issue of staffing. Staffing has always been a problem, and we've been struggling for years to improve staffing in the hospitals to ensure that there are enough nurses to safely and effectively take care of the patients that we have. And we fought for this in our last contract struggle and continue to fight for it. The issue of staffing has really come out clearly as a result of this pandemic, because during the height, certainly, the hospital was overwhelmed because we were already short-staffed. You know, unit after unit already had not enough staff available to meet the needs. And then when we have this flood of patients coming in, new units opening up, people being moved around. So many units we were hearing were working even shorter than before at a time when the need for staffing was so much greater. The short staffing situation that already existed was kind of a setup for disastrous short staffing in the height of the crisis. And then by the same token, as the number of cases has gone down, nurses are learning what it really feels like on some units to have adequate numbers of staff. You know, management is calling it being overstaffed, but in some cases, what they're calling overstaffed is staffing at the level that they've agreed to contractually, or staffing certainly at the level that nurses think is required to take care of our patients under normal circumstances. So nurses are getting a taste of it. They're seeing that it's possible. Hospitals have managed with the right motivation to have enough staff to really take care of patients the way they should be taken care of. My hope is that that translates into a push for really adequate staffing, even in normal times. And that will certainly have an impact on patients with chronic illnesses. When we're short staffed, things like patient teaching really are first things to go, because we need to make sure certainly that we're getting to the patients who are in life and death situations first. Patients are getting their medications. Patients are getting the things that are urgently needed. The patient teaching and the discharge planning that are needed to make sure that be able to take care of themselves or be taken care of for the long haul after they leave the hospital, those are among the first things to go when we don't have enough resources, enough people, and enough time. So I think that staffing is really the crux of it when it comes to addressing these chronic illnesses that you're talking about and addressing them in a longer-term way and not just dealing with the immediate urgency.
Ted Levine, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Darkened sky in its rain.